In the Blues. I'm your host, Jim Ange Anderson. On today's show, we have guitarist, a venerable sideman to blues legends, Little Frank, Frank Krakowski. Let's roll! Little Frank, welcome to the Farmhouse Studios.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ange.
Well, if I can ask, is there a story behind your nickname? Because your real name is...
It's Krakowski, yeah, Frank Krakowski.
Okay.
And to tell you the truth, I was probably 5'4 when I graduated high school. So that, coupled with being around the old guys when I was young, you know, 14, 15 years old, I sort of got the nickname and it stuck.
Okay, well, you know, first of all, I'm intrigued. It's always a pleasure to talk to somebody who's won a Grammy Award. So can you talk about that?
Well, I spent close to 15 years touring with Willie Big Eyes Smith and Pine Top Perkins. And I was on, let's see, 3 records that were nominated for Grammys. And then the last one that I did with those guys, Joined at the Hip, actually won a Grammy. So great lineup on that. It was... me and John Primer on the guitars,
right.
Kenny Beady Eyes Smith on the drums, Bob Stroger on the bass, and I think they had maybe Jerry Portnoy on that as well.
Nice. And so, can you talk about like some of the tunes that are on that record?
Well, Gambler's Blues, it was a tune that I brought to the session. That's an old Lil Son Jackson tune. And Willie, he's one that if you knew him, he always liked to go and gamble. You know, so that's a favorite on the record of mine.
Got no more money, and all I had was gone. You know I threw that money away and sat around with my head hung down. Yes, I threw that money away and sat around with my head hung down. I wake up in the morning, Lord, my face is full of frown.
Can you recall some of the process of the recording? You guys go at it sort of old school, just cut it live?
Yeah, basically they just always went live. Now at that studio, that was Blaze Studios, I believe it's called, in West Chicago, like 3200 West.
Mm-hmm.
The way they do it, you'd have the drums and the guitars in the live room. If the guitars were too loud, they'd go in their own isolation room. But yeah, it'd be the band going at the same time with a scratch vocal, and then the vocals would be overdubbed. And with Pine Top being older, they had to, you know, work on the piano afterwards too.
Mm-hmm. So those both guys, Willie and Pine Top, shared vocal duties.
They shared duties on that record. Yeah, thus the name Joined at the Hip. They were real good buddies for years, you know.
Yeah, I remember seeing them, you know, even seems like at the end of the career that they were a bit inseparable. You'd see them
right.
Just even like hanging out, showing up at a club or at the scene,
oh, yeah.
They'd be together.
Yeah, they were like family.
Yeah. And how did you get connected with those guys?
Boy, there's a family, the Kobecks in South Bend, and I think you know Harvey Stauffer. He's
mm-hmm.
married to one of the Kobecks, Armita, his wife. And there's two guys, Eddie Kobeck. He still is a great drummer. He lives on the West Coast right now. And Dante Kobeck, his brother. Now, Dante would put on these blues shows, Blues Inferno Productions, and they'd bring in everybody. As a kid, I got to see everybody from like Pine Top to Little Milton to Bobby Blue Bland and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember they did a Pine Top show. I think Eddie was on drums, maybe. He'd organize these events with like Pine Top and Dave Myers on bass and maybe Rockin' Johnny or Show
Mania
in the band. And, you know, just being young, you know, they'd sneak me in, you know, the back door when I was under 21 to see these shows. And then Pine Top always liked kids. So for some, you know, there's like this little immediate connection. You know, I went, you know, looking up to him as one of the, you know, the famous Muddy Waters band members. And then he's like, oh, there's a boy that, you know, likes blues or whatever. So he was real nice to me. And I just started going around, you know, started when I was like 14 or 15 to see him play. And he'd let me sit in, which sort of blew me away.
Right.
You know, end of the night, he'd always sort of let me play a couple songs. And when I was probably about 18 years old, this Eddie Kobach that I had mentioned booked a Midwest tour and booked me with Rockin' Johnny on guitars for Pine Top with Dave Myers. And he played drums, Eddie did. And yeah, from then on, you know, I'd sort of get the nod from Pine Top, you know, when they were looking for a guitar player. And then through that, I'd met Willie Big Eye Smith, you know.
Sure.
And, he needed a guitar player around that same time when I was about 19 or 20. And he started hiring me, and then I started doing tours with the two of them. And then when they got the same manager, it was actually Pine Top's manager at first, Pat Morgan. Then she went on to manage Willie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just together, the two of them, we did a lot of work for several years.
Are there, can you think of some highlights of some of the shows you may have done?
Well, one big highlight for me, we did the Kennedy Center Honors in 2008.
Oh, wow.
As a like an all-star blues band tribute to Morgan Freeman,
mm-hmm.
with Coco Taylor and Pine Top were sort of the front persons, or you know, in the group, and Honey Boy Edwards as well.
That's like, so, you know, almost like the pinnacle of
right.
performing arts stages.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it was definitely an honor. And other than that, you know, we did, you know, a lot of great tours, a lot of great shows across the country. You know, different theaters, little clubs, you know, festivals. So.
Wow, that's incredible.
And then Hubert Sumlin was another one, the last at least 5 to 10 years of their lives, that started touring with the two of them together. And
so you worked with...
Yeah, it was an honor to work with him as well. You know.
And you know, to me, he was, I mean, guitar players know, but sort of an underrated...
Right.
Many people have heard his music, but can't recognize it as Hubert. Did you... what did you pick up from Hubert?
Well, I hate to say it, but he was really one of my heroes, you know, so I'd learned a lot of licks off. There's a record with Willie Williams called The Raw and Polluted Soul.
Uh-huh.
I think it may have been done, around the time when Wolf died, but it was Hubert playing some really great lowdown stuff, and I learned a lot of licks off that record and the Real Folk Blues, Hall and Wolf,
mm-hmm.
you know, when I was coming up. So when I remember the first show I did with Hubert, he gave me a solo, and I started playing something. I'm like, well, for one, you're playing mostly Wolf tunes,
right,
you know, in Hubert's
right.
repertoire and some originals. But I just started playing his licks back at him, and all of a sudden, talk about self-conscious. You know,
right.
I just didn't, you know, I had to sort of rethink everything I did, you know, from that point on
sure.
when I was on the stage with him, because I didn't want to be playing that same old, you know.
Yeah, it's hard. Like, what am I going to do? You
right,
know?
Exactly.
Wow. And was Hugh, does Hubert, was he playing with a pick or with his fingers?
Just fingers.
Yeah. To me, that's, it seemed like that's the sound. I'm like, this is not a pick.
Oh, yeah.
This
no,
is
it's
fingers,
definitely
right?
fingers.
Yeah.
And that was sort of funny, too. You'd always see people after the show, you know, coming up for an autograph, and they'd ask Hubert for a guitar pick. Just not knowing.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. Yeah. And so any highlights with Hubert that you could think about?
Just we do, you know, these tours
yeah.
with those guys. Highlights, really for me, every gig was a highlight with
yeah.
that guy, you know.
Were you, with all these guys, were you playing mostly in the States or traveling in Europe?
I was in the States.
Yeah.
You know, with Willie and Pine Top, we went to Europe a couple times. But, yeah, other than that, just mostly, you know, tours of, say, the Northwest or out East.
And, mm-hmm. Where did you guys go in Europe?
We went to Morocco once, played the Tan Jazz Fest, and that was really something. I think they had said at that time that they had like about 99, well, it was over 99% Muslims in that country.
Mm-hmm.
And then we played a cricket stadium. I think they had about 90,000 people or so.
Wow.
And you saw all these people in the traditional Muslim dress,
sure.
you know, and they're dancing to Jimmy Reed.
You know, like, so, what? How did I get here, right?
Right.
That's a long way from South Bend, right?
Yeah.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
Did you do any recording with Hubert?
No.
No?
I wish.
Can you talk a little bit more about some of the other records that you did with Pine Top and Willie?
Well, the first one that, I did maybe five with Willie total.
Really?
Starting with he had a couple Canadian records. I was on, I think, the last one of those. And then we did Born in Arkansas. That was second. After that, he did a release, I believe it was on Blind Pig, maybe, with Bob Corritore.
Mm-hmm.
That was actually a great experience because it was his first U.S. release playing the harmonica out front. He had sort of grown tired of the drums.
Sure.
I think maybe he was hauling the trap case around.
But, right.
He brought in his good friend James Cotton.
Nice.
To, for some support and to, you know, carry a little bit of the harp weight on the record. So it was like Pine Top, James Cotton, Willie, and, you know, Stroger and stuff. But on that record, I remember one of my favorite records as a kid was the Johnny Young Blues Band record.
Mm-hmm.
Chicago Blues Band record,
sure.
I believe it was, on our Hooli. And Cotton, I always thought, had the best tone on that. And it's just so forceful the way he played. You know, I really enjoyed it. Well, sitting next to him in the studio, he was getting almost that same tone.
Wow.
You know, in the studio through a little, like, Valco amp or something.
Sure.
But, you know, that was pretty neat. And then I think after that record was when Willie did Born in Arkansas. It was sort of a collaboration with Kenny. I think Kenny helped to produce it a little more than the last record that I mentioned. And that was done in Chicago, and a lot of originals on there. The Great Barrel House Chuck was
sure.
on that with us. You know, a lot of Farfisa on that record. And then with Pine Top, I did Live on the 88s, it was called. It was recorded live at Northwestern University.
Have you seen Miss Ida B? I know you see her someplace. Hello world. Now have you seen Miss Ida B? Now she's a copper colored brown. Looks something just like a little Japanese. One of them pretty ones. Out of be. Mammy, do you hear me calling you? I know you hear me. Out of be. Darling, do you hear me calling you? Now you is 3 times 7. Swearing you know what you wanna do. Sure do. Nothing but the blues, y'all. All right. Baby, you're still always on my mind, so do. Out of me. Baby, she's always on my mind. Now I can't sleep for dreaming. So when I can't stay, woke for crying. It's terrible. Cried last night. So when all the night before, it's rough. Cried last night. So when all the night before, now if I find my true love, so I ain't going to cry no more.
How about other recordings that you have done with other people?
I've done some records with R.J. Michaud.
Mm-hmm.
Great harp player.
nothing you can do. I got my band on you.
Well, you had mentioned sneaking into the clubs or being escorted into clubs at a young age, 14. I mean, right. When did you start playing the guitar?
Well, I started probably at 12 or 13, and then I put it down for a while, just at frustration. I had friends in school that sort of talked me into getting a guitar, and they were into punk and heavy metal and stuff, and I just thought you could buy a guitar and learn how to play
right.
it. But, you know, there's quite the learning curve, so... I'd given that up till probably 14, 15 years old. I saw right after Stevie Ray Vaughan died, there's a tribute on Austin City Limits
right.
to Stevie Ray, and they had Buddy Guy and Robert Cray as the two featured guests on that episode. Then they had a tribute to Stevie. And it was really my first experience with electric blues.
Okay.
And here they, you know, in the preview for Austin City Limits, they had Stevie Ray, and I was thinking, geez, listen to that tone, you know, just this great big fuzzy tone. And then here comes Buddy Guy, and he had the Jerry curl at that point.
Right.
He was wearing a leopard jumpsuit and playing a Strat just dry through two basements, 410
right.
basements, and I was hooked, like, right there, you know. So I taped that at night and just, you know, started practicing along with that. At 14 or 15 and buying their records. You know, I remember I took a class field trip to Chicago and I skipped out on the field trip and went to Rose Records and Buddy Guy's, you know,
mm-hmm.
just walked down Wabash and I bought like Howlin' Wolf, Real Folk Blues, Buddy Guy, left my blues in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And anyway, just
That's
started.
A great record.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And just started reading about these guys, reading the liner notes, who influenced them. Oh, Muddy Waters. Well, I knew about Muddy a little bit, just like Wolf, but you know, Big Bill, you know, just different people.
Mm-hmm.
And that all sort of snowballed. And then somehow I'd listen to Old Harv, the DJ from
WVP.
WVP from the South Bend, Mishawaka, Elkhart area. He had the blues news. And what do you know? Some of these guys, Jimmy Rogers, you know, that weekend coming through South Bend, there's a place, the Oyster Bar. I don't know if you ever played there yourself.
No, no.
Yeah, they, you know, Jimmy Rogers would come through, or Billy Boy Arnold, or Pine Top, or... You know, just you name it, Sun Seals, James Harmon.
Sure.
You know, so I'd always go down there, and if I couldn't sneak in or sit in with them, you know, my buddy had like a Ford Bronco. I remember we'd pull it up and I'd stand on like the bumper and just look through the window and watch these guys play. You know, and then, like I said, after that time period, I started getting calls for gigs and it became a little more legitimate, you know, than
sure.
just sneaking in.
But, you know, it's one of those things where you're the young kid and you're interested in the music, and the guys
right.
recognize that, you know,
exactly.
you want to play and you're interested in the, and the cool thing, I think, about the blues is that it's a tradition that's handed down. And if you're interested, the older guys are really glad to teach you and show you things.
Right.
You know, I think we've all sort of learned from our elders that way.
Right.
You know, and now that we're a little older, we're teaching the younger kids, you
right.
know, and it's kind of helping to keep the music alive.
Right.
Yeah. You know? Are there any other people in those early days that were helpful or influential to you?
Well, there's a whole crew of local guys, you know, around South Bend. And then the Chicago guys, I'd say probably the two younger, you know, white Chicago guys that I met around this time, maybe 16, 17 years old, would be like Nick Moss and Rockin' Johnny.
Mm-hmm.
And I met a lot of friends that I still have today through them. You know, they were... encouraging and inspirational, you know, watching these guys play with some of the old guys. Dave Myers was another one.
Nice.
From the Aces.
Yeah.
Once again, when I was probably around 15, I met him and he gave me his business card and, you know, I'd call him up and just bug him about whatever. And then I started going up and staying with him, you know, a couple nights here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I got to meet people through him, you know, like Little Smokey Smothers, Junior Wells, Robert Lockwood.
Sure.
You know, all sorts of... You know, the greats that I've always been into, the more, I guess, because of that, the more harp oriented chess blues and
mm-hmm.
whatnot. And, you know, a lot of those guys were still alive at that point.
Do you ever play with Junior?
Never did.
Yeah.
You know, I just was around him. Dave had a night. I forget what night it was exactly. It was early in the week. He'd go and play cards at the checkerboard. And Junior was around a couple times. And then I remember being in the car with Dave once or twice. And Junior lived across the viaduct from him. So he'd be driving by and Junior be in the, you know, on the sidewalk or unloading his van, and Dave would pull up and talk to him
right.
a bit and stuff. So
Junior was a trip.
Yeah.
So You got a little older, and you got old enough to go into the clubs. And you, at what point did you start to venture into Chicago?
Well, that was pretty early on.
Yeah.
You know, I had a, well, going back to people that were sort of encouraging and whatnot, I had met Lonnie Brooks and Ronnie Baker Brooks
right.
at a show, you know, 15, 16 years old. And they had invited me to sit in with them at Buddy Guy's on New Year's Eve around that same time. So, you know, as like I say, maybe 15 years old, went up there and sat in. And, you know, once you get bit by the bug, you know, you want more and more.
Oh, yeah. And especially, you know, starting to play on some of these premier stages with
right.
some premier artists,
right.
you know, that's excellent.
And around that same time period too, probably mid-90s, the Smoke Daddy came about.
Right.
I don't know if you ever
mm-hmm.
you know, ever went there, but Rock and Johnny had like a steady Monday night, and everybody in Chicago, if they're off, would go by there. So
right.
I always try to make the trip, you know, when I could, to the Monday night, because you didn't have to be 21 to be in there and whatnot. And I met a lot of people through that as well.
Do you mind if I ask how old you are now?
Well, I just turned 40, so.
I'm still a young man.
Yeah.
40 is the new 30.
Yeah, that's what I hear, so.
Before the interview, we were talking about the Cashbox Kings, and they have a new record out, and you've been working with them. Can you talk a little bit about that group?
Well, those guys, led by Joe Nosek, who's the band leader, and then Oscar Wilson, the front man, they've been really doing it for the past maybe 10 years or so. You know, they have a handful of records, and they've always had a great lineup. We were talking earlier, Kenny Smith is usually, you know, on drums and definitely on their records. And Billy Flynn and Joel Patterson, you know, they've really put some great two guitar parts together through the past couple records. And I know it's really been a dream of Joe's to, you know, get signed to they were on Blind Pig, but that was sort of hit and miss because I think they're being purchased by somebody else, maybe Sony Music Group or something.
Mm-hmm.
So Joe, I guess, you know, his dream had been to maybe get signed by Alligator sometime, and I don't know how it came about, but yeah, they have this new release and it sounds really good, and I know Bruce is really behind it, and so they work a lot, and you know, I do get a fill in for either Joel or Billy, you know, quite a bit. You know,
those are some big shoes to fill.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, great guitar players,
yeah.
both of them. So,
and I think what's the new record's called, Royal Mint.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. As sort of a sideman, who else do you work with on a somewhat regular basis?
Well, Lazy Lester.
Uh-huh.
It seems like every couple years, year to every 2 years, I do a string of gigs here and there with him.
Uh-huh.
Kim Wilson. Probably about like 07 or so, I started doing gigs, you know, like, not a lot, but like Midwest stuff, you know,
okay.
like a week or two out of the year. And that's, he had a really great band, you know, a couple years back, you know, when Chuck was still alive, and Richard Innes on the drums, and Larry Taylor on the bass, and me and Billy on guitars. RJ Michaud and Billy Boy Arnold.
Right.
Those are two guys. I just did a second annual Mississippi Saxophone Festival down in Clarksdale with backing up Paul Osher, Billy Boy, and Kim. And then backed up RJ Michaud at Ground Zero. So it was a long weekend, but good time.
I mean, that's those are the real cats, right? And so working with, you know, enjoying working with the harp players and that sort of style, I mean, that had to be a perfect, you know.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Sort of gig for you.
Yeah, and that's one thing, you know, I've always, going back to the Dave Myers stuff, I learned how to play not only the top parts, but, you know, took pride in playing the bottom parts and, you know, rhythm behind those players, you know. And so, yeah, definitely at home doing that stuff.
Do you sing at all?
I don't.
No?
It's one of those things I keep saying, yeah, you know, I need to do it, but I'm getting older and, you know, maybe my voice is maturing a little bit. But you know,
it's never too late.
It's never too late.
Willie Buck was talking yesterday about learning to play guitar.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
You know.
Well, I'll tell you what, a while back, well, when I was probably 19 or 20, I toured with Sam Lay.
All right.
And around that time period, he was starting to learn to play guitar. You know, he focused on Lightnin' Hopkins.
Sure.
And some traditional stuff, John Lee Hooker. And he's really come a long way. And
I love
really
the way
good.
He plays.
Right?
Yeah. And here's this guy who's the master, the shuffle master.
Yeah, the shuffle master.
Put down the sticks and he's playing some wonderful guitar.
Right.
You know, so, you know, it's never too late.
Right.
And we're, you know, you're still a young man, you know. It'll take a while before you're an old blues guy. So by
right.
then you can have that singing down.
Perfect voice, yeah.
Right. You talked about Barrel House Chuck and, you know, we lost him recently. But can you talk about your experience working with Chuck?
Well, I just through the years, I did several gigs with him and then ended up on records with him. Never was on a Braille House Chuck record, which I sort of wish that would have happened. But yeah, just, you know, backing up Willie, you know, like I had mentioned. And then there'd been some double shows with him and Pine Top on the piano, and just several gigs in Indiana. You know, he loved to come to the Midway Tavern.
Right.
And they have a great old, probably 1910s or something.
Sure.
Knurled, really fine, you know, grain oak or something, you know, piano he always loved to play. And yeah, he's just a great all around guy, you know, fun to be on the road with.
Right.
And, you know, good hang. So miss him a lot.
For sure. I saw a picture on your website, you with B.B. King,
okay.
King of the Blues. Can you talk about meeting B.B.? And
met him a couple times through the years. The last time, well, we had opened for him at the Morris Civic in South Bend, Morris Performing Arts Center, probably in 2010 or so. And that was the last time I saw him live. And then before that, we'd done the Kennedy Center Honors with him. So just he was one of these guys that he was just a real guy, you know, complete gentleman, and just, you know, he'd take the time for you. If, you know, he felt that, you know, as a fan, if you wanted time with him, he'd share it to the best of his ability. And no ego. You know.
Was BB an influence on your music?
Yeah, I'd say so for sure.
I mean, probably any modern blues player, right?
Anybody. But I was one, I always liked his sort of out of phase tone. You know, not, I didn't, you hear a lot of the generic BB licks. I sort of went for more of the early BB stuff when I was learning. Yeah, he's, you know, just something about it, you know. Thank you.
two-record set on the Kent label, and it's just fantastic. You know, it's just that old stuff, and the band is swinging, and BB is just rocking.
Yeah, I'd say, you know, I like all his stuff up until the early 70s, you know, which I still like it.
Right.
He sort of changed his style a little bit, you know, to the more of a box position, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Second position in the blues position, I guess. I'm not really schooled in theory, but, you know.
Right. Yeah, it's just you know where to put your fingers and how to squeeze the notes, right? But that's, you know, kind of goes along with, you know, a lot of the blues. It's this tradition that's handed down, and you show people stuff, and it's, you know, it's not written down,
right?
You know, or if it is, I wouldn't be able to understand. I look at Tab, and I can't make any sense of that. You know. So you talked about, you know, Hubert Sumlin and hearing B.B. King, or B.B., you listen to B.B. King and that early stuff, as well as the Stevie Ray Vaughan and Buddy Guy being an early influence. I mean, who else would you cite as influences on the guitar?
Well, I pretty much gravitated, like, around the time, you know, shortly after, like I said, that episode I saw, you had Buddy Guy, Stevie, Robert Cray.
Mm-hmm.
Like Robert Cray, he was a little, at that point, a little too much soul for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I gravitated right away to the Buddy Guy, and then next thing you know, I'm buying Cobra Records stuff and getting into the Magic Sam and the Artist Rush and the Junior Wells stuff with Earl Hooker behind, you know, Junior, and definitely Earl Hooker's another influence. You know, I just love the way he sort of transcends genres. You know, he is, you know, hardcore blues, but he is also dabbling in the country realm.
Country, play jazz and big
jazz,
band.
Yeah. Anything, right? You know. But so I'd say probably like the Earl Hooker, Magic Sam, those guys were more of an influence later on to me.
Just a student of the instrument. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How about the slide guitar? Do you play any slide?
Yeah, I play slide. And, you know, just the, well, I'm into the open G and D stuff, but, you know, just out of ease doing gigs, a lot of the standard tuning stuff, whether it be like a Muddy type or Earl Hooker type.
Yeah. Looking at your website, and I think that you and I had maybe even followed some similar paths. I mean, I got into the blues when I was younger. All my friends were out, you know, listening to punk rock and going to see the Ramones and stuff, and I was going to see BB in high school. And I started to go down to the Checkerboard Lounge and down to Teresa's. And I had read where at a young age you were going to the Checkerboard and the 5105 Club. And can you talk about those experiences?
Well, like I said earlier, you know, I'd go hang around Dave Myers, and that was, the Checkerboard was like his place.
Right.
I had a steady night there, and then he'd go and gamble with his buddies, a little smoky and stuff. And yeah, just, I don't, there's just some element of danger about it that I sort of liked early on, you know, and yeah, just the real deal guys that were hanging out in there, the Black Lone Ranger. I mean, where else are you going to find that?
Was Lefty Diz on the scene then?
He had just, I think, passed away.
Okay.
I'm not sure what year he died, but it seems like I had seen him one time. I went to maybe the 91 and then the 92 Chicago Blues Fest.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe he was on one of those or playing around that. But
okay.
He wasn't around the Checkerboard at that time.
Yeah, because he used to do a Blue Monday thing.
Oh, Blue Monday. Yeah. Okay.
You know, I think I'm a little older than you, so I was I was hanging out.
Well, I always go back to this picture, like on Facebook, you know, there's always the dispute of, you know, where the blues is going now. And, you know, some people say it's becoming Disney-fied, you know, and really sort of, you know, anemic. But I always go back to this picture of Buddy in front of the Checkerboard, and he's just got this angry look on his face.
I've seen that photo, yeah.
And you got Lefty Diz behind him and all this. And yeah, so to go there and hang out, it was like, man, this is sort of like the Mecca of what was still going on, you know.
It looks like he was ready to go off on somebody. Right. There was some sort of dispute.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's probably packing a pistol, and they were ready to go at it.
Yeah.
But that's kind of life on 43rd Street.
Yeah.
You know?
And to me, that was the blues right there. That picture just sort of, you know.
Yeah, it's not the downtown Buddy Guy that you see now. You know. But it was dangerous. It's funny because now, I mean, I've drove through that neighborhood somewhat recently. I'm like, what was I thinking, man? I was like, hanging out and going in the alley and messing around all kinds of crazy stuff, you know, but young and stupid, or, you know, just naive and, you know, but, you know, we all survive those things, and maybe it makes you stronger and smarter. I mean,
right.
We have certain street smarts, you know, that it took a few experiences to acquire this smarts, right. You know.
Yeah, that and the 5105. I'd tell any kid that wants to learn how to play blues, you should go back and do a Sunday night with the tail dragger. You know, it's right. Like 5 p.m. till 2 a.m. or 1 a.m. You know, and you really have to be prepared to do that long of a gig. You know, you can't just get up there and play the five licks. You know, and you know.
Yeah, that's the real yeah. the real deal. The, yeah. You know, and the variety of songs, and you got to dig deep down to play that all night and try not to, they say, play the same licks all night.
Right.
You know, I used to play with this guy, Byther Smith, and we do these marathon sets. So oh, you'd yeah. have to go to the bathroom knowing this could be a 3-hour set.
Right.
And sometimes a song would be a half an hour long and your hands would cramp, you know, no matter how you move your hands around to try different positions to play that B, you know, right. lump or something, you know, but that's training, you know, right. that's, you know, that's how you get stronger as a musician, you know.
Now, that's another one that influenced me early on. I didn't buy enough of his records. I probably still should, but Byther Smith and Scotty and the Rib Tips.
Yeah, I played with Scotty okay. on the South Side. Yeah.
Yeah, those were two.
I and Scotty that... brought some of that R&B stuff. I learned right. some cool chords from Scotty. Okay. Yeah. yeah. But Byther, I mean, is a guy, another guy who's just underrated. And yep. just, I mean, he throws down the real stuff. I mean,
right.
you know, when he's on, nobody could touch him.
Right.
You know, and he still plays a little bit, but, you know, he's quite old now.
Right.
Then you should buy more of his records.
I should, yeah.
Well, I understand that you also play some rockabilly.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. I've always... you know, been into the countryside of things and the Sun Records stuff, of mm-hmm. course, and just, you know, different stuff that came out on the King label, Excella label, you know, the rockabilly type stuff, Sun Records, if I didn't say that already. But, yeah, I had a band with a guy from South Bend for quite a while, and he was into, you know, more of the rockabilly side. So people ask me about it, you know, I'm not prolific, like, you know, say like a Joel Pat or something mm-hmm. or whatnot, but yeah.
You like it, and it's another...
Yeah, oh, yeah. You know, I like, you know, pretty much the raw, you know, stuff.
But it's kind of the cousin to the blues anyway,
oh, yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's all the same.
Yeah. You know?
And those guys, you know, like a Scotty Moore, you know, he was sneaking in to see Hall and Wolf every chance he got. You know, James Burton says right. the same thing, so...
It's funny how it all goes back to, you know...
Right, like, the blues, yeah. or the
and
Delta.
And Wolf and Muddy, and, yeah. you know, and then it goes back to Robert Johnson, yeah. you know, so...
It all goes back to Dockery Farm.
Yeah. So was that band Little Frank and the Premiers?
Is yeah,
that your
Little
group?
Frank and the Premiers, yeah. and which I still do gigs under that name.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the older I get, you know, I'm not really little that little anymore. So I keep trying to think of a better name. But you know,
well, it's your handle now, man. You're stuck yeah. with it.
And it survived several incarnations. So
yeah.
I don't know.
Okay. Well, I also had heard at some point you moved to Austin, Texas.
Yeah, me and my wife, Melissa, we've lived there twice through the years, back in 97, then a couple years back, we moved down there, and it's a great town, you know, I think we both decided we like water better, you know, and the proximity to like, say, Lake Michigan, mm-hmm. you know, but yeah, definitely a good town.
I went there recently, never been there, and really enjoyed it, but it seemed to me like it's, like all everybody's working for tips, kind of like Nashville.
Yeah, you could say that. I did gigs that sort of ran the gamut, you know, some were for tips and then others. But the one thing I did realize is, say, like a Kingston Mines or, you know, any club, you know, in Chicago mm-hmm. would have a band, you know, for like, say, a 4-hour gig. Well, in Austin, or I don't know that much about the Broadway scene in Nashville, but in Austin, they'd have like four or five bands that would fill up that same time slot.
Right.
You know, so how can they afford to pay each band, you know, $600 or $800, you know, when you have to divide it four ways. So then you do become reliant, you know, you have a little fee that you get for the gig and then you rely upon tips,
right.
or records from the, you know, record sales from the bandstand.
And then so. When you finish your slot, you have to hustle to another gig to kind of make
it.
You
have to do, yeah, exactly. Yeah. 2-3 gigs a day to sort of make what we make around here.
So it's a different sort of scene.
Yeah.
How would you say the audiences were, you know, Chicago versus Austin?
You know, one thing about Austin, it's really, it's a music town.
Yeah.
You know, so people come out, I mean, when they go out to hear music, You know, I've sort of gotten the feeling, you know, it's hit or miss in Chicago, but, you know, sometimes you feel like you're in the way when you do these gigs of the audience. You know, they're not really there to hear the music. But in Austin, you know, people really do go out at night to go hear music.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many clubs, and yeah, they're very appreciative. I did a handful of gigs on 6th, which, mm-hmm. you know, it's sort of like the
tourist part.
Yeah. It's like the Broadway of Austin. Mm-hmm. And those are more of the tip gigs.
Right.
But, you know, people go there to hear music, and they want to hear blues typically, you know, because of the Stevie Ray and Jimmy Vaughn, you know, and Kim Wilson, the Fabulous Thunderbirds, those guys. So.
Can we talk a little bit about your guitars and equipment and what, you know, what kind of guitars you like to play?
Well, I've always been I started out as a Fender guy, you know, the Fender Strat and Tele. And then probably for the past 15, 20 years, I think I've become a Gibson guy. You know, I'm a fan of the P90 style pickups, mm-hmm. and I've had, you know, old Harmonies, which I've loved, and, you know, different Gibsons. Mainstay's been, I have a 53-ish Gibson ES-350 full hollow body with mm-hmm. two P90s, and a 56 gold top Les Paul reissue with P90s. And, yeah, just different stuff. Like today I brought over an SG special with P90s.
Fine.
More of a Gibson guy and Fender amps, you know, and then for recording, you know, Harmony amps, Silvertone amps, you know, smaller, 5 to no more than 15 watts, you know.
How about when you're playing live?
Well, for years I used a 66 Super Reverb, mm-hmm. which I still use, and then I have a 310 Tweed Bandmaster clone. So those two for years and years. With the Tweed amp, I always like to bring along the Fender Reverb tank.
Right. Why the blues?
It just something about it, you know, grabbed me, you know, and I really had just a little experience. My dad had some like Fats Domino records, and then when he'd hear like a blues radio show, sometimes he'd put it on. But yeah, just something about it. Maybe at first it seemed more obtainable, like with the guitar when I was starting mm-hmm. to learn, but just something about the overall simplicity plus the like raw aggressive sound that some of these guys got, and the tones attracted me. So I was one of those people you hear about. You probably interview people and they say, well, you know, I found out about the blues through like say Eric Clapton or whatever. Well, I sort of found out about rock and roll backwards, you know.
Okay.
I got into the blues really first, you know, like really in my musical journey or whatever.
Right.
And then it wasn't until probably the last 10 years I started getting into, you know, some of the rock and roll stuff, you know, that I just sort of bypassed, you know.
Well, that's fun. And yeah. It's nice to catch up on what you've been missing.
Yeah.
And, you know, you touched on this a little earlier about the state of the blues. I mean, I've heard some people say it's a dinosaur, it's a dying art. And then I personally think it's alive and well, and, you know, like everything, certain trends come and go, and sometimes blues goes up in popularity, goes down, but I don't think it's ever going to go away.
Right.
But you touched on the sort of Disneyfication, which I think can maybe even happen in Chicago, similar to New Orleans, where people want to show up and they want to hear
Sweet Home Chicago.
You know, but I think that there's a scene, and there's a lot of young people playing.
Right.
And it's, you know, what are your thoughts about the future of the blues?
Oh boy. Yeah. It's a tough one. You know, there's a good portion of the young people coming up that are into the real deal stuff. But then I see a lot of, you know, I was criticized a while back for a Facebook post about, you know, like the Blues Music Awards. It just seems like a lot of the nominees and the people that are getting the attention don't really have much weight behind them. I'm talking musical weight, you know.
Right.
And it's like, I just see the quality of the music, you know, at least the stuff that's getting the attention. There's a lot of great stuff that's not getting the attention it deserves. And some of the smart people are actually trending more towards the Americana or roots
mm-hmm.
side of things than the, you know, dependent on the Blues Music Awards and the blues side of things. Because, like I say, it just seems like a lot of the people getting the more of the attention aren't really the heavy hitters.
Sure.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think.
And that's the way it is.
It's a popularity contest,
right,
almost,
exactly.
You know, and who's got the nicest hair versus
exactly
the nicest shoes, you know?
Right.
And even if you think back at some of, you know, the other older artists that we were talking about, you know, maybe, you know, Earl Hooker didn't get the recognition right. that he should have, you know, and people like that, where there are other people maybe got recognition and weren't quite as
qualified.
You know, yeah.
So
what are your plans for the future?
Well, I have a couple of 45s that I record that I've been dragging my feet to put out. But I did one session with Larry Taylor from Canned Heat on the bass and a guy named Pete Curry from the Low Straitjackets on the drums. And that's more of a, I'd say, avant-garde type blues. There's also like a sort of Duane Eddy tune that I did. We recorded enough for two or three 45s. And then on the blues, real blues side of things, a couple years back, I did some recordings with Martin Lang, who's been putting out some great records recently. Just recorded with 158 microphone. And we got some really good results. And it's just sort of sat in the can, you know, for probably 3 years or so, but I'd like to put out some 45s with that too. So,
some literal discs.
Yeah, literal, you know, the wax.
Yeah, yeah.
And then with, you know, like a download card or whatnot.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's cool. So what do you see, where do you see yourself in, you know, when you're 60, 20 years from now?
Probably just plugging along doing, you know, sideman gigs like I do now, but who knows?
Yeah.
So maybe I'll start singing and, you know, back up my words for all the, you know, the criticism I dish out on the modern blues, you know.
Well, what do you say we make some music?
Sure. Sounds good.
Thank you.